The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. I had the good fortune of speaking with Matt Southwell this week. He's a drug policy reformer and harm reduction activist in the UK and a project executive with the European Network of People Who Use Drugs, or EuroNPUD. We're going to hear that interview today. Matt, to start, tell my listeners about yourself and about organizing with people who use drugs.
My name is Matt Southwell. I'm a drug user activist, and I'm a drug specialist working in international development and undertaking global advocacy on behalf of people who use drugs. Yeah, look, I was a very young harm reduction worker. I was one of the first generation of UK harm reduction workers. But I'd done my HIV training in a HIV organisation run by gay men and set up by gay men and led by gay men living with HIV. So I was, you know, taught this model of community mobilisation and community engagement, and saw, you know, people with professional backgrounds also working in community networks, and saw the value of that process. I then got a job, but I was part of the volunteer team, one of the few drug users in their process. So I then got a job working in drug services, working in the National Health Service, and I applied that community mobilisation model with people who use drugs. Luckily, I wasn't managed for the first 6 months of my job, so that I actually was able to demonstrate the effectiveness of it before anybody realised what I was doing. And I realised that it was a completely alien model in drug services, not a model that was widely adopted. We did it for 10 years, employed drug users, supported drug user groups, did highly pioneering work. And then the government changed drug policy, moved back towards a greater model of criminalisation, away from harm reduction. And I saw the professional sector, particularly some of the professional sector come in and sort of close down the organisation, push me out, sack all the drug users, and then start to deny that we'd ever done the work because they couldn't replicate it once they got rid of the drug using staff. So at that point, I realized that this is actually a political struggle, and actually it's not just about health. No, if we can do something that's so successful and they still want to destroy it, that speaks to this underlying problem that people have this judgment towards people who use drugs, which is fueled in criminalization, and that stops them even seeing good work when it's being done. So that really led me into this process of doing two things. On one side, seeing that we need to organise as people who use drugs, we need to run our own self-organisations. And on the other side, there is a very effective process of using communities to reach out to communities to deliver peer-led harm reduction or to deliver health intervention. So it's partly self-organisation for rights and partly promoting health through community systems.
It's fascinating, and it's so vital. I mean, nothing about us without us. I mean, we have to be able to speak up, and I do mean we. I am a person who uses drugs. I don't like opiates. I prefer stimulants, and I've stopped using a lot of the things that I used to use. But I still, it's like I say, we all use drugs in one kind or another. Exactly. The hypocrisy is the problem. Once we get past that, we can start talking about actually treating people who use drugs like we're human beings or something radical like that. So now some of the ways that your advocacy advocacy and organization take shape. I was just on a webinar with you about a new project on opioid substitution treatment and take-home doses, getting people. Tell me about this, because I mean, in this country, it's hugely, horribly overregulated, you seem to have made a lot of more progress.
Yeah, look, I mean, I think there's been real challenges in a number of different countries about the use of opiate substitution therapies. In some countries, France, Germany, we have a wide range of options. Germany has 6 different OST options available to its client group, offering a real range of treatments from long-acting drugs to partial agonists to full agonists to injectable versions. And that recognises that different people at different points in their journey may benefit from different drugs that support them in different ways to achieve positive change. The problem is a lot of the treatment models are designed with a dominance abstinence model. So the predetermined outcome is that we should be using opiate substitution therapy to either achieve abstinence and stop using even opiate substitution therapy, even though it's a recognized long-acting medication that for many people is useful for life. And even if we use it successfully, then we're expected not to use any other illicit drugs. And I think it's about saying, well, no, we are drug users. We may be choosing that we want to help to manage our opiate dependence and to bring control and stability to that. Does that mean we'll never use any other drugs? No. Or that we'll always have problems with other drugs? Well, that's not really the experience. Some people can have a problem with one drug and either stop using it or recover control, while other people, and while having perfectly functional relationships with other drugs. And I think, no, people go on journeys with drugs. Drug use evolves over their life. And I think what we need to design is a treatment system that is able to support people much more like an extreme sport model. So it's like physiotherapy, helping people get back on line again, rather than a model at the moment, which seems to say to people, you are powerless, you are hopeless, you are going to always fail. Welcome to treatment. It's like, what the hell is that model? That's not a model that's helpful. It's not founded on the principles of motivation, which say, yes, we need to understand our problems, but we also need to have the self-belief and self-motivation and purpose in life to change. So I think at the moment, drug treatment has become squashing people, forcing people into compliance and making people miserable, not empowering people. During COVID, we've seen people given weekly take-home doses of opiate substitution therapy, something that most people have to take their medication every day and sometimes every day under supervision. Suddenly people have been given this freedom and the response has completely shocked the professional sector. The vast majority of people have managed, the vast majority of people have actually used their self-regulation to make life changes, to live better lives. And in fact, most people are reporting that not engaging in treatment services, not picking up their scripts every day, means their lives aren't dominated by drugs, because that's where they met the drug suppliers, that's where they met the people hassling them to use drugs. So now we're having this huge debate about how do we, one, protect these take-home doses, and two, how do we lobby for a system that is less paternalistic and more supportive, and that therapeutic alliances is the goal, not a model of containment and punishment?
This is a conversation with drug policy reformer and harm reduction activist Matt Southwell. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Now, I've got to find out. Many years ago, the UK was famous for having prescription heroin available for people who were using opioids, diacetylmorphine, whatever. Is there still heroin prescription available within the UK?
Yeah, so yes, there is, but we've been through this very difficult period. So we had this famed British model, and back in the day, it included both cocaine prescribing and also dimorphine prescribing. And so there were people who and had very good results, but it was always a minority practice. And we had some people left on those prescriptions from the 1960s, but you couldn't normally get onto them, with the exception of a pioneering clinic in Liverpool run by Dr. John Marks, who was a very famous pioneer of that drug, of that model of prescribing. So more recently, the UK has been through 15 years of regression. We've seen this dominance of the recovery model. We've had conservative governments pushing this, despite 8 out of the 11 of their last leadership contenders all acknowledging their own drug use, their historic drug use. No, they have implemented a policy which is very much targeting poor drug users and trying to restrict their benefits and make treatment more hostile and all of this type of stuff. So we've been through this very difficult situation. Now we've seen a real reducing of quality of harm reduction. We don't even count how many needles and syringe programs we have in the UK at this point, let alone how many needles and syringes we give out. So we can't even comply with WHO reporting. But unfortunately, we have been taught a very, very harsh lesson, which is in 2015, we had our first HIV outbreak among people who inject drugs. Now 250 or so drug users in Glasgow, among the street drug using population, particularly when there was an arrival of injecting cocaine. No, there wasn't enough needles and syringes in the community. There wasn't enough outreach engagement. And now we've got a population of people that will be paying to be on antiretroviral treatment. That epidemic is still ongoing. And I even understand we have a parallel outbreak going on in Belfast as well. So look, this is the consequences of not following through on harm reduction and thinking that you can let go. And that's surprising. I mean, we've now seen a resurgence of public health thinking since COVID. But there does feel a mood for change in the UK, but it's no, the current government is caught. Everybody's caught in this debate on drugs, which is no, it's a big lie. No, it's the big lie, but they're all brought into the big lie for so long. How do they back off from the big lie without looking like they're a bunch of liars? this is the challenge of how do we unwind this system and move backwards. But yeah, the British model has been in a very difficult place for a long time. We're in this long-term decline. We've also seen 25% cuts in our public service through austerity, and that also savaged our local drug services. So this combination of austerity and recovery, drug-free targets for drug services, all of the things that led to a decline in drug treatment numbers and the highest ever drug-related deaths, and an HIV outbreak. What more messaging do you need to show that harm reduction works?
Okay, let's talk about one of these. Let me switch over to this to one of the other things you've been working on, because I was on a webinar with you about this recently, and Operation Drugs Vote. Before we started, I was telling you that I started way back in 84 with an initiative petition here in Oregon, and then working in that, I've always found that, retail politics and wholesale politics, you got to get out there and you got to be upfront about what you want. There's all these things you got to do. And I thought Operation Drugs Vote sounds like a brilliant idea. And tell folks about that. Tell me about Operation Drugs Vote.
Tell me about it. So Operation Drugs Vote is a concept, and it's a Hail Mary in some levels. Now, we've been going backwards in our drug policy for 15 years. But at the same time, I think post-pandemic, as we come out of lockdown, there's a desire for something substantial. Young people have had a radical left leader who mobilized them and excited them and engaged their vote in a way that we haven't seen for many years. The problem was he was from the left and couldn't build a coalition with other voters to create the constituency to get an electoral result. So now the Labour Party has moved into the centre ground and is struggling to hold on to that dynamism of young people voting. So for me, that's one of the catalysts. The other catalyst is the yearning for racial justice. We've seen in the US that understanding the link between drug policy reform and racial and the journey towards racial justice, I think, has been a key driver of drug law reform discussions in the US. We think that's not so present in the UK, but we think to achieve drug law reform, we have to make it much more present. And we do have seen the Black Lives Matter movement in the UK was very powerful. It was particularly linked to this desire to address our historic relationship with slavery. The British Empire was obviously deeply explicitly driving that process. So that's why when Nixon comes up with a big drugs lie, the UK, as a tool of racial oppression, of course, that's easily adopted in the UK because it fits with our history of racial injustice and slavery. So I think understanding that young people are looking for something politically dynamic, there is a deep social yearning for racial justice and more broadly for an investment in our social care and healthcare system, because people have seen the damage that austerity has done to our health and social care system. So rather than, I think, seeing drug policy as this issue to hide behind and hide and put into the margins and feel scared about, I think for me, what Operation Drugs Vote is about saying is, look, actually, Operation Drugs Vote does all of that. It is a radical agenda. It's a social transformation agenda. It's potentially a racial justice agenda that could both take the pressure off black communities, but also have a boosting economic effect, because it would also boost our country you know, because it, you know, it would release entrepreneurialism, all those other things, and if, and we could, you know, actively make sure that the communities that were most devastated by bad drug policy are now helped through good drug policy. So that's the idea. The reason that I think this is an option is that the Labour Party, which is the party that really needs to find a voice and a way forward with its new leader, if they adopted a policy that is currently in front of them from the Labour campaign for drug policy reform, if they adopted that policy, we would have a progressive coalition for at least legalisation of cannabis, enhanced harm reduction and full decriminalisation. So our first campaign is to go after the Labour Party with a campaign that we've called I'm Cool Britannia.
I'm old enough to remember Cool Britannia. So, Matt. Yes, I know. Tony Blair spelled B-L-I-A-R. Yes, all that. Yeah. Then again, I think Brian Cox is a... I think Brian Cox may support, you know, reform. So you might be able to get... you might be able to get, you know, things can only get better. A little remix.
Definitely part of our game plan. Yeah, no, I'm sure that TikToks with things can only get better is going to be part of the campaign. It's just that I'm too old to understand how that bit would work. But that's why, you know, key partners in this project are Students for Sensible Drug Policy UK, who understand how to mobilise that stuff. And I think what we're trying to do is play on that history, which is to say, no, a lot of people were very critical of Tony Blair for saying, you're publicising this concept of Cool Britannia, but actually demonising the people who make Britannia cool. And actually, that is illogical. And then you're using dance music from our community while increasing criminalisation against our community. And it's like, so on some levels, what we're trying to do in the Cool Britannia campaign is to not see it as a very commercial expression of Cool Britannia, but actually saying Britain is cool because of its history of youth culture that goes with very explicit musical expressions, from mods to rockers to, you know, dance culture to lots of different expressions, and almost all, in fact all of them, are associated with different forms of drug taking. So if we can really embrace the idea of that's what Cool Britannia is, and if you embrace this idea of I'm being Cool Britannia, you're actually saying I embrace drug policy reform. And we're saying particularly to Keir Starmer as the leader of the Labour Party, are you cool? No, because if you're cool, you would support drug policy reform, and then we could have a progressive alliance that could transform our country and do what the government from the Labour government of the 1945 did when it founded the NHS and founded the welfare state. And that's the ambition we have. We understand it's a Hail Mary, but if you're not ambitious, then nothing gets done.
That's really cool. I wish you all the luck. I think it's an excellent idea. It's the only way to go. I mean, what's the alternative? You know,
yeah.
Give up and hide. Well, I mean,
yeah, I absolutely agree. Well, I mean, I think my biggest fear in many ways is that the progressives don't embrace this agenda, because then the conservatives will deliver it on a commercialized model, because they're looking at cannabis legalization. But of course, they've got to work out how to deprogram their people from the big drugs lie, because they've told them all that cannabis causes schizophrenia. So now, how can they now make the money they want to make, but deal with the big drugs lie? Now, that's not going to take more than an election cycle to sort out. So I think that's why I think Operation Drugs Vote is so key, because now is the moment. It's a post-pandemic period. We're likely to be entering a new roaring 20s that either becomes a point of social conflict where drugs becomes the point where we fight our governments, or it becomes a moment of social transformation where we start to say, let's use it for a transformative experience. Let's make our society different. Let's have a different way to interact with our police. Let's have a, you know, different way that we can support young people. So rather than criminalizing 50% of all young people, we actually sit there and say, let's empower you to live pleasurable, empowered lives where you manage risk, rather than let's surround you with risk and wonder why you end up experiencing harm.
This is a conversation with Matt Southwell.
The chemical I'm about to ingest is odorless, tasteless, and colorless. It's addictive. Can be lethal in large quantities. And it's harder and harder to get in its pure state.
You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. You just reminded me of the thing that I wanted to ask about, and that's about the supply. You mentioned that, for instance, the overdose crisis in Scotland being driven part with the benzos and the alcohol. Of course, in my country, fentanyl has been one of the big drivers of the overdose crisis. We've always had contaminants in the illegal drug supply because that's the problem with an illegal drug supply, is you end up with contaminants. And when it's a powder drug, fentanyl, the synthetic opioid, has been. Has the UK been seeing that at all in the supply there? Or is that just
not so much? We've not seen fentanyl as yet. I've been in Canada and experienced both heroin cut with fentanyl and in fact pure fentanyl, which was like purple solution, which was bizarre. And actually, for me, as someone who enjoys opiates, heroin is, we describe it sometimes like being wrapped up in your mother's arms, being this very nurturing, warm and caring hold, and it's this sort of glowing feeling, a bit like the Ready Brick Kid, if you have that sort of all-over body glow. And fentanyl is much more of an anesthetic. It's much more something designed to knock you out. So whereas heroin would last for like 5 or 6 hours, fentanyl is a 4-hour acting drug. No, when I took it, it just knocked me out. And I came round again 3 or 4 hours later thinking, what on earth was that about? For me, in fact, I decided to go home early because I was scared the living daylights out of me, to be honest. It was a drug that seemed so strong. And also not that pleasurable. And then what I was also hearing then was like drug users are then locked into. So rather than before, where you had a drug that lasted for 6 hours, so you could use like 3 times a day, so you had to raise your money for 3 doses a day, suddenly you're into a cycle that requires you to use 4 or 5 times a day. And then your dependency is so, so severe, because fentanyl is 40 times stronger than heroin, and carfentanil and others are even stronger. So then you've got such an intense dependency. So I saw US friends come to a European conference having to use like 7-8 times the amount of their European peers, because they were trying to match fentanyl tolerance with normal heroin tolerance. And I think this is just the craziness of prohibition, which is it, you know. Very good friend of mine who is used to be one of the heads of the Metropolitan Drug Squad, and he became a drug law reform campaigner through that experience. And his line was always, which is, if drugs are so dangerous, why are we asking organised crime to manage them for us? And I think, no, for me, that's just so logical. If we're ending up with more and more dangerous forms of drugs coming into the supply, and it's driven by traffickers' desire to get things across borders, not because of choice, not because of pleasure, not because of better effect. That just shows how prohibition drives harm. And for me, the fentanyl story is horrific. I mean, I can't believe how many people have been lost in North America. But it's an absolute case study of why drug control doesn't work, and why drug control always drives us towards the most harmful outcomes and the most harmful forms of drugs.
The new psychoactive substances, novel psychoactives, how widely known are they there in the UK?
Yeah, so look, we had a very methadone became a very big issue for a period of time. We had a media scare. In fact, I spoke to the journalist who started it, and he was hugely apologetic. But I started this story talking about his new demon drug, and just created this drive for it. And then lots of people jumped into the market, started selling it, because at that point it was called legal highs, because it actually wasn't regulated. So methadone was the big novel psychoactive substance. It still remains a drug that about 30% of people use. So it's the biggest by far of any of the MPSs. other cathinones and other different types of MPS stimulants have entered the market. We have a whole population of spice users. It's particularly taken hold in prisons where people can avoid drug testing, and it's causing huge problems with prison violence because it's no longer just simple cannabinoids. It's actually now a whole range of other things that are very psychoactive and associated with people being very out of control and quite violent. And that's being soaked into socks and paper and everything. So incredibly difficult to stop getting into prisons. And then it's also being used a lot by the most vulnerable sort of homeless population, particularly people who can't really afford some of the other drugs. And they'll use this as an alternative sort of blocking out, knocking out type engagement. So, I mean, other parts of Europe have seen, like, fentanyl is much stronger in places like Estonia. So, we do have some people who use fentanyl, but it's more diverted. The other big MPS, which is ketamine. So we've had a lot of ketamine use, particularly coming out of the Free Party, Squat Party, and then the gay dance scenes. Some of that's becoming part of chemsex, but we've also had a whole population that's got really lost with ketamine bladder syndrome and ketamine dependency syndrome, getting into daily ketamine use, causing lots and lots of problems. And it's because it's largely a regional problem spotted in the areas where we had parts of the party scene, that we just have struggled to get our government to really take it seriously. And we've, you know, these are people losing their bladders potentially. And we've actually found out really interesting advice, information about what's happening and how you can reverse that and how you can even recover your bladder health. But because there's no dialogue between people who use drugs and the people who are struggling and the professional system, then that narrative is very much a self-learning narrative among people who use drugs. And we're still grappling to get the professional system to have more of a discussion. So ketamine is the oldest of the MPS, methadone probably the largest. And then there's just a plethora of other things that people are using that change so fast and move so quickly, come in with different harms, go away again, and it's those are very difficult to track.
Wow, yeah, it's a fascinating conversation, and I cannot thank you enough for all your time. Tell people how to find you, you on the web and social media, and also on the web, how people can find some of the resources we've been talking about, the substitution treatment advocacy stuff, the drugs vote, and all that.
Yeah, so look, my name's Matt Southwell, spelled with one T, so M-A-T Southwell. You can find me on Facebook, and I'm Matt Southwell on Twitter as well. You can also find the European Network of People Who Use Drugs, which is where I currently work, and you can find that on www.euroempud.net, and you'll see a number of different places where we share our resources and share our information. So look, please reach out, make contact. We have a global movement as well. So look, we have a great network in the United States called the Urban Survivors Union, and that's our sister network in the US. So please reach out to the network in your local state, in your country. It's time to organize.
That was my conversation with Matt Southwell. He's a drug policy reformer and harm reduction activist in the UK and a project executive with the European Network of People Who Use Drugs. You can find EuroNPUD on the web at euronpud.net. And that's it for this week. Thank you for joining us. You've been listening to Century of Lies. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long! For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the century of lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.